With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
We have an active shooter. We have an active shooter inside the warehouse.
Welcome to Active Shooter, a podcast that covers the whys, the hows, and the aftermath of active shooter and mass casualty events.
They have an active shooter in the building. A second call says they are being attacked.
I've been shot.
169 San Diego, we got shots fired at 415 AS, Route 91, sounded like an automatic firearm.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter, active shooter,
active shooter, mass casualty incidents.
Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Active Shooter, a podcast that may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
Good morning, America. Breaking news, deadly church shooting. Tragedy in Charleston. At least 9 people killed overnight in a massacre in an historic black church.
I do believe this was a hate crime.
Police say this suspect, a white man in his 20s, walked into the Bible study, sat down with the group, and opened fire.
This is a most unspeakable and heartbreaking tragedy.
Though this podcast typically ends each show with the conclusion or belief that serious mental health issues existed with so many of the shooters, mental health issues that, if properly treated, closely monitored, and evaluated, may have been the difference between deadly destruction and preserving human life. Adequate mental health care could be a contributing factor in the eventual elimination of mass shootings. On the other hand, some of the shootings are rooted in deep-seated hate, evil, and pure racism. Today's case is just that, a reflection of how terrible things can go wrong when such racist beliefs are nurtured and allowed to grow over the years, past the point of no return. Because the extent of information provided is voluminous, we will present today's case slightly different from our typical format. First, we will discuss the shooting and then transition into the investigation and background of the shooter. In the second half, we will introduce the victims and some of their backgrounds. We will also explain how the members of the Mother Emanuel AME Church expressed love over hate, basking the shooter in the kind of forgiveness that the Lord himself would show. For that was the way of the congregation, and how the dearly departed would likely want it as well. Today's case, if you haven't already guessed, is the mass shooting at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. If you haven't yet guessed which case this is, it may be because the shooter's identity was splashed all over social media and TV, making this shooting more well-known by the name of the shooter, rather than the place and the people whose faith he could not destroy. Though we will discuss many facts about the shooter, it is the sincerest hope of this podcast team that after listening, you will recognize it because of the victims, survivors, first responders, and church that lost so much on June 17th, 2015. Not because of the shooter's name.
Active Shooter, the podcast, is a High Five Holly production, and I'm your host, JT. If you've listened to our prior episodes, you know that the Active Shooter podcast team has taken the No Notoriety Pledge, and we will not be sharing the real name of the shooters that we cover. We will be giving the shooters a pseudonym and refer to them by that name throughout the episode. This will help in clearing up any confusion in the story, while remaining true to our pledge in not naming the shooter by their actual name. We will refer to today's shooter as John.
Wednesday, June 17th, 2015 was a very humid, sticky, hot day in Charleston, South Carolina. The day turned to evening, and dusk slowly fell over the city as residents bustled about, running last-minute errands for the day, or quieting down the children, who were still buzzing with excitement over the beginning of the summer season. At the Mother Emmanuel, AME, or African Methodist Episcopal Church, located at 110 Calhoun Street, the Wednesday night Bible study was about to commence. The church was a beautifully preserved old building that was erected in 1891, making it the oldest AME church in the South. Though the exterior underwent several repairs and renovations over the years, the interior remained wonderfully intact, with much of the original charm and fixtures. It was very large, holding a capacity of 2,500 people, and thus was one of the largest black churches in Charleston. 21-year-old John arrived in Charleston at approximately 7:45 p.m. on the evening of June 17th. Armed with a Glock 41, 45 caliber handgun with hollow bullet points, he drove a dark-colored Hyundai Elantra that he parked in the lot adjacent to the church. At about 8:06 p.m., John entered the church through a side door, which entered directly into the Bible study room that was located in the basement. Bible study had already started when John arrived. Participants looked up to notice a young man with a slight, nearly frail-looking build. His hair was styled into a bowl cut, and he was wearing a gray long-sleeved shirt with a white t-shirt underneath, black pants, and a tactical pouch. He carried 7 magazines. Each magazine held 11 hollow-point bullets, and the gun, which had a magazine inside. All were concealed in the pouch. Evening Bible study was already in progress with 12 attendees present when John joined the group. Parishioners eagerly welcomed John into the fold without hesitation. Their immediate acceptance was a stark contrast to the animosity that John later displayed. Reverend Clementa Pinckney invited him in to join the group, which John did, though he sat with his head hung low and eyes downcast. The Reverend handed John a Bible and worksheet for that evening's topic. While John made nearly no eye contact, he seemed to be listening and following along intently.
Came in, quiet, sitting there quietly. We thought maybe it was a College of Charleston student or something, because we would have them come in periodically.
Tywanza Sanders uploaded a Snapchat video of himself at the Bible study, and John could be seen in the background, though he most certainly wasn't attempting to be caught on camera. As the Bible study was coming to a close, parishioners stood and closed their eyes, bowing their heads in prayer. As this was happening, John began firing the first shots. There is some contradiction as to whether John was standing or sitting when he started shooting. He claimed he was still sitting, but survivors later reported that he had stood in prayer with the rest of the group. The most likely scenario is that he was standing, after having pulled the weapon from the pouch simultaneous to rising from a seated position. After the initial gunshot, people started diving underneath tables or running for safety. Witness Felicia Sanders thought the noise came from a newly installed elevator, but then she saw it. She screamed, "He has a gun!" But John had already committed unspeakable damage. Reverend Pinckney was the first to be shot, struck with 3. Fatal shots.
Felicia yelled, "He's shooting everybody, get down." So I hit the floor. And then that's probably what saved me. The bullets was flying everywhere. But I thought sure I was going to die.
Reverend Daniel Simmons Sr., often thought of as the backbone of the church, was a 74-year-old pastor who always carried his firearm with him. Except for that day. It was one of the only days that he didn't have it, though whether it would have helped or not will never be known. The attack was so wholly unexpected and shocking, the victims and witnesses so vulnerable in their moments of prayer, it's difficult to know if any other outcome would have been possible. Reverend Simmons Sr. was shot twice, which forced him to stumble backwards. He was shot a few more times, 4 in total, and he was still alive when John fled the scene. But he later succumbed to his injuries at the hospital. Tywanza Sanders was also shot several times and perished soon after the paramedics arrived. However, after he was shot, he tried reasoning with John, asking why. John simply stated in a cold, flat tone, "I have to do it. You rape our women, and you're taking over our country, and you have to go." It is one of the most disgustingly vile things any human could utter. Tywanza managed to stand up to John, trying desperately to protect his mother, niece, and Aunt Susie. His niece, who was only 11 years old, was in her mother's arms when her grandmother, Tywanza's mom, Felicia Sanders, laid atop her, acting as a human shield, protecting this young life from the horror that John was intent on inflicting on each innocent person inside the church that day. Tywanza was killed with his arm outstretched towards his Aunt Susie, as his mother watched the most devastating event any mother could see. She witnessed her own son's murder, and there was nothing she could do. Sharonda Coleman Singleton and DePayne Middleton Doctor were both shot and killed. Sharonda had 3 children and DePayne had 4, all girls. DePayne's girls were supposed to join her for Bible study that evening, but at the last minute, she allowed them to stay home. A decision that proved to be one she would have been deeply grateful for, even if it meant leaving them motherless. Myra Thompson was going to be leading the Bible study for her very first time that night. She received her preaching certificate that afternoon and was looking forward to taking the lead for the first time. Sadly, Myra was also killed that night. The church's librarian, Cynthia Hurd, was also shot and killed, as was Ethel Lance, the woman who was responsible for cleaning the church, and she loved decorating the church with fresh flowers. Ethel was shot 7 times. During the shooting, John paced about the room, screaming at people that were hiding under tables. He reloaded his weapon several times, much to the horror of those that were concealed from John's sight. Susie Jackson was shot 11 times, more than anyone else. Polly Shepherd was hiding underneath one of the tables when she froze, in sheer panic. John's boots stopped, right next to where she crouched, trembling in fear. John heard Polly praying and snapped at her to shut up, and then immediately asked if he'd shot her yet, to which Polly replied, "No." John dispassionately told her that he wasn't going to kill her. No, he would leave her alive, so she could tell his story.
"That's why I didn't shoot that other lady. I could have, but I didn't."
"Do you remember telling that lady, 'I'm going to let you live so you can tell my story?'"
"Or yeah, like that. I remember saying that, but you know, there's really no story."
As soon as he said those words, John raised the gun to his head and pulled the trigger. Except nothing happened. He was out of ammunition. John had reloaded 7 times, using up every last bit of the one thing he needed to continue the mass destruction inside the beautiful old church. During a pause in the shooting, Polly managed to call 911, begging for help. Jennifer Pinkney, who was hiding out in the pastor's study with her daughter, was also able to call 911 to report the shooting.
"Please answer.
911, what's the address of the emergency?"
"Please, Emmanuel Church, there's many people shot down here. Please send somebody right away."
"Emmanuel Church?"
"Emmanuel, Amy, 110 Camel."
"And there's people shot?"
"Yeah, he shot the pastor, he shot all the men in the church. Please come right away."
Okay, my partner's going to be getting some help on the way. Will I get a little bit more information from you, okay? Stay on the line with me. Are he's you still, safe? Are you...
He's still in here, I'm afraid. He's still in here.
Where are you?
I'm in Emmanuel Amy Church on one.
Yes, ma'am, but where are you inside the church?
In the lower level.
You're in the lower level? Where is the shooter?
He's in the office.
Yes, ma'am, I've got officers en route to you. Don't hang up with me. I want you to stay on the line with me. You stay as quiet as possible. Do you hear me?
Yes, I'm under the table.
What is your name, ma'am?
Polly Shepherd.
All right, Miss Polly. Like I said, my partner's getting some help on the way while I get this information from you, okay? You stay on the line with me.
He's coming, please.
Okay, ma'am, are you able to... If he's coming, I need you to be as quiet as possible. Is there something that you can hide under?
I'm under the table.
Did you see him at all?
Yes, he's a young 21-year-old white dude.
Okay.
We got some people very hurt, please.
Yes, ma'am. And you said that, were you able to see the gun? Do you know what kind of gun it was?
No, I don't know anything about guns.
Okay, that's okay.
The scene looked like something from a war movie. Blood was all over the place, leaving the air with an almost metallic taste. There was so much. The floor was stained red as it flowed all around deceased bodies, mixing with bodily fluids that excreted as victims passed from this world. Shell casings laid everywhere, and the stench of gun smoke and fear lingered in the air. John fled the church, muttering behind him about plans to kill himself, which was later testified to by Felicia Sanders. Outside video surveillance camera showed John leaving the church at about 9:06 p.m., exiting through the same door he entered. As he walked away, he could be seen dropping his tactical pouch. He got into his car and drove away. It was later reported by John during his interrogation that he hadn't planned on surviving the shooting, and therefore had no further plans, meaning John didn't exactly know what to do next. Absent a plan, he drove around aimlessly. Meanwhile, police had arrived and photos of John and his vehicle were being splashed across the evening news all over the country. A manhunt was soon underway and lasted throughout the night. A woman named Debbie was driving when she noticed a vehicle with a 3-flag Confederate States of America bumper sticker. This gave Debbie a chill to her core. You see, she recognized this car from the news and believed it to be the Charleston church shooter. Debbie also noted the unmistakable haircut and knew in that moment that she was uncomfortably close to a mass murderer, one she believed was unpredictable and could start shooting at random at any moment. And this made her incredibly nervous as she called in the sighting. John's half-sister recognized him from the news, too, and called the police to report what she knew. At 10:44 a.m. on Thursday, June 18th, John was arrested during a traffic stop in Shelby, North Carolina, approximately 245 miles from the church. The police officer ordered John from the vehicle, and as he was getting out, police noted a GPS unit sitting in his lap. One of the officers asked John if he was involved in the Charleston church shooting, and John simply replied, "Yes." John informed police that there was a firearm in the back seat. After police retrieved the .45 caliber pistol, a thorough search of the vehicle was conducted. John was handcuffed and taken to the Shelby police station to be held until the FBI could arrive and begin their interrogation.
This is an ABC News special report. Deadly church shooting. Tragedy in Charleston.
And good morning, I'm Amy Robach. We are interrupting your regular programming for breaking news in that deadly church shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. We have just learned the suspect, 21-year-old has been caught in North Carolina. Attorney General Loretta Lynch confirms he is now in police custody.
A full investigation had already started even before John was arrested, and anything he might tell police could help fill in any missing gaps of information. John waived his Miranda rights and immediately confessed to the shooting, which will be discussed at greater length shortly. On the investigative end, police used the GPS unit found in John's car to review the routes he drove before and after the shooting. The FBI was able to determine that John left Columbia at 6:13 p.m. and drove approximately an hour and a half to Charleston. Based on the GPS data, the FBI knew that he had made several trips to Charleston before the shooting, stopping at various plantations and snapping selfies on the beach. Videos were found, and they depicted John doing target practice in his backyard, shooting at various objects in the yard. A search of the house in the yard later produced numerous shell casings, corroborating the videos. On June 20th, 2015, the FBI discovered a website in John's name. The website held John's 2,444-word manifesto, which detailed each of the dark, disturbing thoughts that made John such a terrifyingly dangerous person.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter, active shooter,
active shooter of mass casualty incidents.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter of mass casualty incidents.
Telephone records were obtained and showed that John made a phone call to the church in February. Though the records were from a landline inside John's house. He didn't have a cell phone at the time, but it could safely be presumed that John was the one who made the call, at least, when taken into consideration with the rest of the overwhelming evidence. Richland County Sheriff's deputies went to John's home, really, his mother's house, the day after the shooting. After she was informed of what her son had done, she collapsed to the ground. When she was able to regain her faculties, she allowed police to search John's room without a warrant. A digital camera was found with images of John standing before a Confederate flag. There was a significant amount of ammunition located, and a photo was taken of a white pillowcase that was cut into a triangle. The officer that took the pictures of the pillowcase later testified that she did so because, quote, "To me, it represents what could be a Ku Klux Klan hood." The interrogation of John was most atypical compared to how they typically transpire. John confessed in full and provided a mountain of details of how and why he committed such atrocities. He claimed to have purchased the firearm about 2 months before the shooting. He confessed that the mission was to kill black people. John planned to purchase, quote, "the big, the best, the biggest caliber of gun he could find in an effort to seek retribution for the wrongs he believed black people committed against whites." John boldly stated he intended to start a race war and admitted that he killed perfectly innocent people, but tried to rationalize this grotesque statement by saying that black people kill innocent white people every day. The absurdity of this statement is a scary reflection of the darkness in John's heart. He continued by explaining to police that he's researched churches and other places online, but ultimately chose the Mother Emmanuel, AME Church, because it seemed like a good place to find black people.
You know, it's an historic AME Church. I mean, I guess that's pretty much the reason.
Well, how did you find out about that AME Church in Charleston? Did you research it?
Yeah, I just looked up black churches.
On the internet?
Yeah.
Where'd you do that at?
There's a website called SCI Way, like SCIWay.net. You know, it's got a bunch of stuff about South Carolina.
Okay. So you went on the internet to look to find black churches, and you knew South Charleston had a high black population. And it was
right, well, I could have done it in Columbia, too. There's black churches in Columbia. It's just, I don't know, I just wanted to go to Charleston, I guess. I don't really know. At the Times or something, I guess.
Was that an African-American woman or a white woman?
Yes. Well, this is an African Methodist Episcopal. Is that what AME stands for? I think that's what it stands for.
That's why you wanted to
Is that why you chose that church?
Oh, yes.
Because you were looking for African-Americans.
Right.
John said that he originally planned to seek out a festival, attended by mainly black people, but decided against it because it would likely be heavily secured by police and guards. A church felt safer, due to its very nature of accepting outsiders with open arms and believing in the good in others. Churchgoers would be much less suspicious and much more attainable. The entire thought process is so unsettling, yet proof that deep-seated racism still can exist in the hearts and minds of some. John knew of the Bible study at the Mother Emanuel AME Church because he admitted to making a previous visit where a parishioner was standing outside and told him about it. John was preparing and planning for months before carrying out his attack.
Were they having a meeting or something?
No, this was a Bible study class.
So you knew the Bible study class was going to happen?
Yes. Because I had went there before and I asked them.
Okay, so you've been to the church before?
Well, not in it.
But outside, said, when do you have Bible study?
Well, yeah, I just saw somebody get into their car and I asked them.
When was that?
Oh, that was like, oh, God. That was probably... I don't know.
He purchased the Glock 45 semi-automatic pistol at Shooter's Choice on April 16th, 2015, and spent the next couple of months buying volumes of ammunition, including 45 caliber hollow point bullets and a laser sight.
Well, did I kill him? Oh, well, I guess. I mean, I don't really know.
Well, I
don't know how many people or anything like that.
So, did you shoot him?
Yes.
What kind of gun did you use?
A Glock 45.
Okay. Was that your gun or?
Yes, I bought it from the gun store.
Which gun store did you buy that from?
Shooter's Choice.
In West Columbia, Shooter's Choice.
Well, it's in Columbia. I'm not sure.
They got the indoor gun range there.
Yes, but yeah. I've never used it, but yes. Yeah.
A mere week before the shooting, John bought 88 bullets at Walmart. They, too, were the hollow point bullets, which expand when they hit the target. John talked about photos he had taken of himself using a timer on a camera. These photos contained images of John burning an American flag, and two of him in a cemetery, one for Confederate soldiers, and one for former slaves. It cannot be stated enough just how sick, disgusting, and horrific John's actions, thoughts, and ideas are and were. What was, perhaps, the most sickening statement John made was when he indicated that he nearly didn't proceed with the shooting because the folks at the Bible study were just so nice to him.
You had a thought about leaving, right?
Yes, I did.
But then you said, no, I'm here, I gotta do it.
Right.
He certainly underestimated the pure kindness and compassion he would encounter from his victims. John also told police that when he left the church, he stopped at an ATM to obtain $20 in cash so he could stop for gas along the way. Many admissions of racist thoughts were made, including statements such as, "I did it. I killed them." He thought everyone would run for the door.
Whoa. Yeah, I mean, I went to that church in Charleston,
He was in awe that no cops showed up after he fired 77 bullets.
You can leave, so where do you go?
Well, to be honest, I was in absolute awe that there was nobody out there after I had shot that many bullets. I was like, right. Oh my God, what are these cops doing? They're not even really doing their job. If you hear how many shots, I don't know how many shots that was.
You know, what is it? 7 times 11.
77. You know, and there's not even a cop outside. You know, so obviously, when I walked out that door, you know, I peeked out the door. Because I thought there was going to be somebody there ready to shoot me, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, that's really why I had the last magazine. Is not to shoot cops, it's so I can shoot myself. You see what I'm saying?
And finally, he expressed shock that 9 people were murdered, saying it made him feel bad. John's demeanor was so nonchalant and emotionless that it was eerie that less than 24 hours earlier, he had committed such a malicious act of mass murder. John was born on April 3rd, 1994, at Baptist Hospital in Columbia, South Carolina. His parents divorced a few years before his birth and then reconciled, which is when John was born. The couple broke up again, for good, shortly after. John's dad was a carpenter, and mom was a bartender when he was born. When John was about 5 years old, his father remarried in November of 1999, and his stepmom went on to become a major influence in his life. His dad and stepmom divorced about 10 years after getting married. As a child, John admitted to having odd thoughts and feelings, and as early as 8 years old, he recalls noticing that he would often notice things, like the clouds moving too fast, which he deemed was a sign that something bad was going to happen. He had a compulsion for washing his hands, sometimes using an entire bottle of soap in one washing. Most would describe his childhood years as coming from a broken home. John attended 7 different schools within 9 years. But each school was in a middle-class neighborhood, and had as many black students as white, and John grew up having several friends that were black. He moved a lot between Lexington and Columbia, South Carolina, and went to school in Lexington for 4th, 8th, and 9th grades, and in Columbia for 5th grade at Rosewood Elementary School. During his 5th grade year, John was described as shy and never really part of the crowd. Several former classmates stated that though he was introverted, he certainly never made racist comments or treated his black classmates differently. There were no signs of the dark young man he would eventually grow into. Despite the many moves and appearances of a broken family, John's grandfather was a well-known local attorney, and the family was respected. When John was a teen, his parents struggled financially, and in 2009 his mother was evicted from her home, and it was during these years that he was primarily raised by his stepmother. He had an older half-sister and a younger half-sister, although it's unclear how close John was with his siblings growing up. His dad restored old historic homes, but his business fell deeply into debt, and he went under, closing within a few years. In the 9th grade, John was attending the White Knoll High School, but he was struggling greatly and, as a result, was required to repeat the 9th grade. When he was 13, and in 8th grade, John started smoking marijuana. At age 14 and in 9th grade, he started smoking cigarettes and drinking. By 17, he was smoking a pack per day, and had been caught spending his money for pot as early as middle school years. After taking 9th grade for the second time, John decided to drop out for good in 2010, though he ended up earning a GED online. He was rarely employed and couldn't seem to hold a job, making his employment history very limited. Once he dropped out of school, John was experimenting with drugs and alcohol pretty heavily, and as such, had a few run-ins with the police. Around this time, John began reading white supremacist websites. And only months before the shooting, he started bragging to others that he was going to start a race war. Despite his growing dark thoughts, John's interests seemed much like other teenage boys. He liked skateboarding and playing video games, and even wrestled for a time. For about 2 months, in 2014 and 2015, John worked at Clark's Termite and Pest Control. Co-workers noticed that John would sometimes be caught staring into space, and when co-workers ate lunch together as a group, John would go sit alone, and his boss recalled that he often had trouble keeping John on task, and frequently had to call John back to the present. One co-worker asked John what he did for fun once, and John responded that he didn't do anything except go home and stare at the wall.
All I've ever had was just doing landscaping, you know, like lawn maintenance, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what it was.
Okay. And
about 4 months before the shooting, John posted a picture of himself on Craigslist, seeking a companion to take a historical tour of Charleston with him. The ad indicated that John would not go with certain people, and went on to list those people as being Jewish, gay, and black, although he used much more offensive language. A retired psychologist saw the ad and reached out to John. The psychologist did so, believing he might assist in expanding John's view of the world and other people. He even offered to pay John to view certain TED Talks on these subjects. John simply continued using hate speech, and declined any offers from the former psychologist. While John had few, or no, real friendships, he apparently connected with a few younger individuals using the library computer. John went to the library to use the free computers and ended up making a Facebook account. After setting up the account, he friended about 88 people, many of whom were black kids he previously went to school with. During his later interrogation with police, John stated he requested 88 friends because the letter H was the eighth letter of the alphabet, and HH meant Heil Hitler. Therefore, 88 was the number of friends he would have. Whether he sent friend requests to black people because he eventually planned to target them is unknown. Why he chose those 88 people specifically is unknown. In the weeks before the shooting, John reconnected with a boy he knew from middle school that we will call Ken throughout this case. John was staying at Ken's house many nights before the shooting, and the young men hung out quite a bit. Even with this friendship, John was reserved and distant. He seemed to enjoy the other boys' company, but oftentimes, when he was at Ken's, John would become so overwhelmed that he would nearly have a panic attack, and would have to go out to his car and blast classical music as loud as the speakers would go. John alleged that this calmed his nerves. Ken was never really certain what would set John off like this. On March 2, 2015, the police were called to the Columbiana Center Mall because John was there, walking about and asking bizarre questions to shoppers, and acting out in an odd manner. When police arrived, John was found to be in possession of Suboxone, and he was very high on the same drug. He was charged with drug possession and banned from the mall. Suboxone is typically prescribed to treat opiate addiction, though many abuse it as a recreational drug that is known for its euphoric effect. Later writings of John's, from his time in jail, went on at length about his drug use, specifically how he wasn't attempting to self-medicate. John just liked to get high. Those that actually knew John said he would make comments about killing people, though as is often the case, they just didn't take him seriously. John was partying and heavily using drugs in the days leading up to the shooting. He was sleeping in his car a lot, and while he claimed he only really drank when he could afford it, it seemed he often could afford his favorite pint of vodka in the time leading up to the shooting. John estimates that between the ages of 15 and 21, which is how old he was at the time of the shooting, he was using benzodiazepine, also known as benzos, on occasion. This includes Xanax, Klonopin, and Valium. He also used opiates, including hydrocodone about 10 times, and oxycodone about 10 times. He admitted to using Ambien recreationally about 30 times, and used cocaine about 5 times. He used Suboxone for about a year before the shooting. John's parents were pressuring him to get a job, which doesn't seem outrageous, considering he was a full-grown adult. John did meet with a psychiatrist after the shooting, but before the trial. The doctor noted that John paid an abnormal amount of attention to his hair, ensuring there was never a hair out of place. He indicated that John avoided eye contact initially, though over time, he connected more. John was easily distracted, and jump from one topic to another, never discussing one thing for very long. One thing the psychiatrist noted was that John smiled at inappropriate times, such as when discussing dark subjects. He also exhibited strange behaviors, and made odd comments such as denying being depressed, but admitted to getting anxious, displaying hypochondriac tendencies, and acting out in childish ways. The only time he showed any suicidal ideation was he said that if his hair fell out and he was bald for his eventual trial, he would kill himself. The doctor reported that John made some delusional self-proclamations such as, his head was lopsided. The right side of his ribcage is smaller than the left. His right leg was shorter than the left. Right arm was bigger than the left. And he had an obsession with losing his hair. While in jail, John kept track of how many hairs he lost when he showered, and he was absolutely petrified to go bald. The doctor noted that John seemed preoccupied with how many hits his Wikipedia page had, and how he believed that the world was not safe. White people were under attack, according to John. When John was 19 years old, his uncle attempted to mentor him, but John pushed him away. He eliminated contact with the majority of his family, but reached out on occasion. One of his half-sisters sent John an invitation to her wedding, but John didn't even acknowledge it, let alone attend. On March 13, 2015, John was investigated for loitering in his parked car near a park in downtown Columbia. A subsequent search turned up 6 unloaded magazines and an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle forearm grip. When questioned about the items in his car, John said he wanted to purchase an AR-15, but couldn't afford one yet. It wasn't illegal to possess a firearm grip in South Carolina, so the police weren't obligated to charge or hold John. He was arrested on April 26, 2015, for trespassing, when he was found on the Columbia Center Mall's property after his warning, and the trespass ban was extended for an additional 3 years. As mentioned, John was living with his mother at the time of the shooting. They shared a spacious home near the Congaree River in Columbia.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter, active shooter,
active shooter, mass casualty incidents.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter. Mass casualty incidents.
41-year-old Reverend Clementa Pinckney was born on July 30, 1973, in Beaufort, South Carolina. Coming from a large family of 6 children, Clementa began preaching at age 13 and was appointed pastor at age 18. He graduated from Allen University in 1995 and in 1996, when he was only 23 years old. He became the youngest black person elected to the South Carolina legislature. In 1999, he earned a Master of Public Administration degree from the University of South Carolina, and in 2000, Clementa was elected to the state senate. While at the university, he also studied at the Lutheran Theological Southern Seminary and was known for pushing legislation to assist police officers in obtaining much-needed body cams for all police. The Reverend Clementa Pinckney is survived by his beloved wife, Jennifer, and their 2 children, Eliana and Milena. He will be mourned not just for the incredible humanitarian efforts he put forth, but for the amazing husband and father he was. Tywanza Sanders was the youngest of all the victims. He was only 26 years old. Born in Charleston, he attended Ferndale Baptist School for elementary and middle school, and graduated from James Island Charter High School in 2006. Tywanza then attended the Denmark Technical College in Denmark, South Carolina, before graduating in 2014 from Allen University, where he majored in business administration. He was an incredible student and loved to learn, even obtaining a diploma in applied science in barbering. His interests included creative and performing arts. Indeed, Taiwanza started writing and composing music at a young age, and this led him to poetry writing. During college, he performed poetry readings at many open mic nights and loved sharing his passion with the world. Once he graduated, Taiwanza worked as a licensed barber and had recently been accepted to Full Sail University in Florida to pursue a degree in media and communications, and was due to start classes in the fall of 2015. A scholarship was created in his name, called the Taiwanza Sanders Legacy Scholarship, benefiting high school students graduating from the state of South Carolina. Taiwanza is survived by his mother, niece, and many other friends and family, who will fiercely miss the gregarious, loving young man. Reverend Sharonda Coleman Singleton was a 45-year-old assistant pastor at Mother Emmanuel AME Church. A native of Newark, New Jersey, she graduated from Valesburg High School in 1987 before attending South Carolina State University, where she earned a bachelor's degree in speech pathology and audiology. She was a proud member of the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority and an award-winning hurdler for the SCSU track and field team. Eventually, Sharonda went to Montclair State University and earned a master's degree in speech language and pathology. In 2008, Sharonda started working for Goose Creek High School as a speech and language pathologist and was the head coach of the girls' track and field team there. Family was everything to Sharonda, especially her children, sons Christopher and Kaylin, and daughter Cameron. Reverend Sharonda Coleman Singleton will never be forgotten, and her legacy lives on in her dear children. 54-year-old Cynthia Graham Hurd was born on June 21, 1960, and died only 4 days before her 55th birthday. A Charleston native, Cynthia was a manager for one of the branches of the Charleston County Library System, and looking very much forward to retirement after working for 31 years at the Charleston Library. One of six children, Cynthia's family were all members of the Emmanuel AME Church growing up. She graduated from High School of Charleston and attended Clark College, where she earned her degree in mathematics. Her career in the library began in 1984. Cynthia was married to a merchant sailor who was at sea near Saudi Arabia when she was shot and killed. After her death, the Cynthia Graham Hurd Foundation for Reading and Civic Engagement was formed, something she would have been extremely proud of. Cynthia was posthumously awarded the Phoenix Award from the Congressional Black Caucus. All that knew and loved Cynthia will miss her dearly, though her name lives on. DePayne Middleton Doctor was 49 years old when she was murdered. The mother of four girls, she had just begun a new job at Southern Wesleyan University's campus in Charleston as a student services coordinator. DePayne was dual employed, working also for Charleston County, where she worked with the county's poorest residents, helping to obtain aid. She frequently attended prayer services during the week, as she was working towards becoming a minister. DePayne is survived by her daughters, and her loss will be felt for eternity. 87-year-old Susie Jackson grew up in Charleston and graduated from Burke High School. She sang soprano in the church choir and was a member of the senior citizens group at the church. Susie recently took a trip to Cleveland to visit her son and grandchildren, whom she adored. Susie liked to get out and about, and truly loved playing slot machines, and was scheduled to take a bus trip to Chicago shortly after the shooting happened. Known as a deeply warm-hearted woman, Susie went out of her way to help others in need, and it is that thoughtful, generous spirit that Susie will be most remembered for. But they are the same traits she will be the most missed for. She will never be forgotten. Ethel Lance was 70 years old when she was killed. She grew up in Charleston and was a lifelong member of the AME Church. Ethel had worked for over 30 years as an original member of the housekeeping staff at the city's Galliard Auditorium before she retired in 2002. She served as the head custodian at the church for the previous 5 years, and she truly loved to help keep the church clean. Ethel loved gospel music and was able to listen at the church she visited on a near daily basis. Her husband preceded her death in 1988, and her greatest joy was caring for and loving their 5 children, 7 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. Her family will fondly remember how Ethel always served her grandkids grits and bacon, and how much she loved to take her family to gospel performances at the auditorium. Ethel will be missed every day by those she left behind, but they know she is in the arms of her husband in the house of the Lord until she can greet them on the other side. 59-year-old Myra Thompson was born on December 5, 1955, in Charleston, South Carolina. She was leading her very first Bible study on that fateful day, a responsibility she was so eager for and deserving of. Myra had been relicensed to preach only hours before the shooting that took her life, although it is a small comfort to know she was able to achieve her goal before going home to the Lord. During the 80s and 90s, she was a teacher at Brentwood Middle School in North Charleston, and she loved teaching. In 1994, Myra earned her Master of Education in Reading Education from Citadel Graduate College. She attended the Zucker Family School of Education, and in 1999, she achieved her Master of Education in Counseling Education, which is no small feat. Myra leaves behind 3 children, 11 brothers, 3 sisters, and her soulmate, Reverend Anthony Thompson. He wrote a book after the shooting, detailing his journey through healing and forgiveness. There's a link in the show notes. Myra will never be forgotten. All of those who loved her will be certain of that. 75-year-old Reverend Daniel Simmons Sr. was born on July 16, 1940, in Clarendon County, South Carolina. He graduated from Palmetto High School in Mullins, and then attended Allen University, where he earned a bachelor's degree, before going to achieve a master's degree in social work from the University of South Carolina, and a master's of divinity degree from Lutheran Seminary. A fourth-generation preacher, Daniel retired from preaching full-time in 2013. He served his country in the United States Army, something Daniel was proud of. He married the love of his life, Annie Simmons, and together they had 2 children, a son named Daniel and a daughter named Rose. They also had 4 grandchildren. They all miss Daniel very much, but are comforted knowing he is in heaven, waiting for the day they will all be together again.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter of mass casualty incidents.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter of mass casualty incidents.
The shooter was charged federally with 33 counts that include 9 counts of hate crime act resulting in death, 3 counts of hate crime act involving an attempt to kill, 9 counts of obstruction of exercise of religion resulting in death, 3 counts of obstruction of exercise of religion involving an attempt to kill and use of a dangerous weapon, and 9 counts of use of a firearm to commit murder during and in relation to a crime of violence. He would have been extradited from North to South Carolina, which he waived and was flown to the Sheriff Al Cannon Detention Center in North Charleston. A mere days after the shooting, he appeared in court by the jail video system. Family members of the victims attended the hearing and were obligated to hear that the shooter wrote his mother a letter about wishing he were home in her arms and apologizing to her. Yet the shooting victims, families, and survivors offered nothing but forgiveness to the shooter. Bond was set at $1 million for the weapons charge, and no bond for the 9 counts of murder. Lead prosecutor for the federal case was Assistant U.S. Attorney named Jay Richardson, who was based in Columbia. The court appointed David Brooke as defense counsel, and again, the shooter wrote a note, this time to the judge, explaining that he wished to represent himself, thinking his attorney would be entering an insanity plea. He believed his attorneys were mistaking his personality traits for autism, and he wasn't comfortable with it. Attorney Brooke had worked as an attorney for over 20 years in South Carolina, having also served on the defense team for the surviving Boston bomber, which took place in 2013. The defense team attempted to establish an agreement where the shooter would plead guilty to all charges if the death penalty was taken off the table. prosecutors did not even entertain the offer. On November 28, 2016, a hearing was conducted, and the shooter again asked to represent himself. The judge warned that this was not in the shooter's best interests, but he did allow it. The shooter represented himself for the jury selection phase, but had counsel for the trial and penalty phases. The federal trial commenced on December 7, 2016, which was about 18 months post-shooting. Judge Richard Gergel presided over the case that was tried by a jury consisting of two black women, eight white women, one white man, and one black man. A number of the victims' family members, along with the church's new pastor, attended the trial, as did the mother and paternal grandparents of the shooter. At one point, someone noticed that the shooter's mother was slumped over in her seat, unresponsive. She was rushed to the emergency room where it was determined that she had suffered from a heart attack. She survived, but didn't attend the trial after that. The shooter's father attended, though not consistently. The prosecution's first witness was Felicia Sanders, who owned and operated a local salon until after the shooting. Her husband sat in the front row for support the entire time she testified. Approximately 12 officers from the Department of Homeland Security were stationed outside the federal courthouse, located at 85 Broad Street in Charleston during the trial. The county courthouse is directly across the street. On December 8th, standby counsel for the shooter requested a mistrial after a witness coined the shooter as evil. The judge denied the request and moved on with the trial, and on December 15th, 2016, the shooter was convicted in federal court on all 33 counts, after a jury deliberated for 2 hours. On January 11th, 2017, the shooter was sentenced to death. With regard to the state trial, the shooter pled guilty to all counts against him by the state of South Carolina on March 31st, 2017. On April 17th, the shooter was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the state charges, which was the result of a plea agreement where the shooter pled guilty to everything in exchange for the state taking the death penalty off the table. The federal case was appealed, which is standard when there is a guilty verdict in a trial. On August 25, 2021, the United States Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the death penalty sentence, and the case is now being appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court takes up a very small percentage of cases brought before it. Therefore, it isn't likely that the shooter's case will be heard. However, we will post an update should there be any new reports. To this day, the shooter has never shown 1 ounce of remorse for his deadly actions. A lawsuit settlement was reached wherein the U.S. Justice Department must pay a total of $88 million to the victims of the shooting after they accused the FBI of a faulty background check, which allowed the shooter to purchase a firearm. According to the official history of the Mother Emanuel AME Church's website, Reverend Richard Allen founded a Methodist church for blacks in 1787. When the Methodist church attempted to control Reverend Allen's church, he split from the Methodist church, and on May 19, 1816, he established the African Methodist Episcopal Church. On July 15, 1818, Reverend Morris Brown and his thousands of followers amalgamated with Reverend Allen's African Methodist Episcopal Church, and eventually, a place of worship was erected in the Hampstead neighborhood of Charleston. One member of the Hampstead Church, Denmark Vesey, won a lottery and purchased his own freedom, after which he tried to organize a large-scale uprising against slave owners in 1822. Another slave informed his master of the plan, which led to the arrest of 131 men. The majority were tried and convicted. Some of the men were acquitted of the charges, yet were still banished from South Carolina. On July 2, 1822, Denmark Vesey was hanged as his punishment for the attempted rebellion. Many others suffered the same fate, and the Hampstead Church was later burned by a local group of angry whites. Tensions remained high for some time, and as a result, church members met less and less frequently, though others continued to hold services in secret. Bishop Daniel Alexander Payne re-established the church around 1860, and later, Reverend Richard Harvey Kane became the pastor. The church was obliterated by an earthquake on August 31, 1886, although the current church, which stands on the original foundation, was rebuilt in 1891 and 1892. They say that history repeats itself, and the history of this church is no different. In the early years, several white men who held no understanding of the love and fellowship the church represented destroyed the building that many held so dear, an act indicative of the hatred that lived inside each one of them. Over 100 years later, a lone white man, filled with the same racism and hate, perpetrated an attack so devastating that it was meant to destroy the church once again. What this shooter could never have understood, just as the men that burned it over a century ago could never understand, is that the building was so much more than lumber, nails, altar, and pews. The church structure was the physical manifestation of the devotion of thousands of faithful, yet severely marginalized people. Despite the hatred they were met with, love was represented in the hearts of its congregation, but above all, members from both congregations displayed pure forgiveness and a will to survive, overcome, and thrive. We all have the unique ability to help prevent such a catastrophic event from happening, if we keep our eyes and ears open, and never hesitate to report when something or someone just doesn't seem right. It is our sincerest wish that there will be no more active or mass shooting stories to tell. We pray that love will prevail over hate.
Too many have died! We should say to ourselves, not one more!
In the meantime, we urge our listeners to stay aware of your surroundings and keep in touch with your loved ones. If you see something, say something. You never know how many lives you'll be saving.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Active Shooter, the podcast. Remember, if you see something, say something. There's no telling how many lives you may be saving. A huge thank you to Darren Curtis, who composed some of the music used in this episode. Check him out at darrencurtismusic.com. DarrenCurtis. Music.com.
Active Shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active Shooter.
Active Shooter with mass casualty incidents.
Make sure to check us out on social media. We have a discussion group on Facebook. Just search for Active Shooter, the podcast discussion group. You can also find us on Instagram at Active the Podcast and Twitter at Podcast Active. For just $1 a month, you can get access to ad-free episodes, early release episodes when available, and a shout-out on the show. Just go to patreon.com/activethepodcast. Thank you, and be safe.